Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet, and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic.
This episode brought to you by The Other Side, an Annie-nominated blog featuring over 1,000 posts about witches and RPGs. From Tim Branning, author of numerous OSR, D&D, and Pathfinder supplements, you can find so many articles to read, plus free downloads and character write-ups and more. Check out the link in the show notes. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Covenstead podcast. This is our Covenstead. Come, the door is always open. I like to think of this Covenstead as being the inside of an old tree that has been hollowed out by a family of beavers, and as we've made it our own little place. And you know, over towards the side we have a collection of different incenses and candles and everything to help you feel warm and invited. Mm-hmm. We've got some benches over to the side. Come, yes. Please sit, relax,
and considering the season, we have a pine and some maybe you know, red and green candles, very festive, some pine cones and acorns. It's very decorated for the season. I like that.
I like it. I like, yeah, very nice, very nice, yeah. So this is, I am Todd, and with me is my coven mate, Danny. Say hello, Danny.
Hi, Danny.
I've been thinking about how we do our openings, and I've been thinking, you know what, I jump right into the conversation, so I wanted to try something a little bit more kind of nice and formal. So what do you think about that one?
Nice. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of play around with the whole Covenstead thing. It's like it got me thinking there's a show up here in Canada way back when I was a kid. Don't look up when, it's not healthy for any of us. But it was called The Friendly Giant, and there was always a part where it was just a regular sized guy, but with tiny puppets around and stuff, and he had little pieces of toy furniture, and he'd always kind of set a space aside for the viewer to come sit with him during the show and all that. And it just got me thinking, it's like, I'm going to try that. Anyways, I am rambling. we are here, we're gonna do basically picking up where we left off with our last episode, where we were talking about playing as the GM or as one of the players. And because Danny made such a convincing case for being a player in ways that I had not considered, we got so in depth to that, we wanted to go a little further and start talking about player roles, which is basically a way of looking at everyone else but the GM in a game, because there's way more to it than just, okay, I am player, here is my character, and go. So yeah, I'm looking forward to this, especially too, you really got me thinking after the last our last recording that I'm looking at starting up an online group where we would rotate so that everyone would have the chance to be a GM for like 3 sessions, and then everyone else gets a chance to be a player in different games and stuff like this, so that I can try things out a little bit more as a player rather than a GM. So you are reforming me.
Cool. I mean, imagine our podcast making us think, right?
I know, right?
Yeah, not to toot our own horns or anything like that, but...
No, I think we should toot our horns more often. There should be more tooting on this show. I mean, of horns, tooting of horns. That's what it should be. But anyways, so let's talk about player roles.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different ways you can take this. When you're talking about a player and their role, you have their role as a player, as in what are they responsible for doing at the table? Like keeping track of their numbers, keeping track of what abilities they have, paying attention to what's going on, allowing people to shine, you know, sharing spotlight, you know, all of those mechanical things, right? But then you also have player roles in the sense of like, what niche is their character filling, right? And how do they play that? And how do they play their role at the table in the game itself and in the story? And, you know, in another sense, the player role for the personal, like on a personal note for the player themselves, you have the character, the player, and then internal as a character, like what their role and how they act in a game can also determine like what they want to get out of it to begin with. Like, what are they there for? And so, you know, any of those three things can affect like how that person views their place at the table, in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally, for sure. I mean, even to how it frames certain classes of characters and their role within the party and everything. It's like if we look at D&D as the, you know, the classic example, you've basically got like the defender, you've got the healer, you've got the magic user, and then there was somebody else. Clearly, it's been a while since I played, but there were very core, you know, roles within the party to make sure that no one was taking that particular spotlight away from the others. And I think the cleric is the one is always like the most definitive one, or the healer of the party, so to speak, whereas that they are there to keep everyone else going in the game, that when someone takes a serious hit, they're the ones who are supposed to run in when someone yells medic. And you don't want to have someone else. Maybe every once in a while someone has like a backup plan in case something happens to the cleric, but that's their role. That's what they do in the party. You always know who is the one that's supposed to go first, who's the best scouter, who is it was just like, this room looks suspicious. Mm-hmm. Okay, we send in the rogue, search for traps and all this kind of stuff. Because, yeah, and then this way someone's always got their default thing to do, and it really helps the game move faster rather than asking, well, who's got this skill? Who's got the highest of this? And who should go first? I don't know. I feel luckier today, you know?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And actually, it's funny that you brought this up. We brought this up now. We're talking about this now because just today I was doing character creation for a Vampire 5e game. Brand new vampire game. Yeah. And we were talking about our characters because these are all things that you should talk about in session zero. What do we expect of the players in terms of like bringing their character sheet, in terms of marking their stuff down, in terms of writing down NPC? You know, what are the mechanical things we expect the player to do? And then what does everybody want out of the game? What's their hope out of the game? And then third, what are your characters going to be doing? What is their role in that session? Talking about it in this game and talking about it together really just makes a cohesive group where everybody can shine. Like, for instance, in the vampire game, like I said, it's good that we talked about this. Like, just we had our session zero today, like just before I got on with you. And nice. So we were talking about, okay, we're vampires. What do we want to do? And we kind of decided we're in Chicago. We're vampires in Chicago. We're kind of like heist-oriented coterie. Like, we're a heist-oriented group of vampires, like Leverage, Ocean's 11, Sneakers, any of that stuff. So we start talking about what characters everybody wanted to play. One person wanted to play a Ravnos confidence man kind of thing. Well, that works for a heist thing. We need a confidence man. And our other one was an Nosferatu who wanted to do computers. Perfect. We need an informational person for heists and stuff like that. And then our other one was a Toreador who kind of wanted to be sneaky and know how to get in places and stuff like that. Perfect. We need somebody like that. So then it was left to me. And so I looked at what we had and I'm like, you know, we don't have anyone who can fight, like who's experienced fighting. So I made my character the hitter, like the one that knows weapons and knows martial arts and knows melee and is strong and stuff like that. And talking about it together, you know, because I didn't have my heart set on anything. And I think that this is going to be really fun to play. And we all have our own strengths in the group because we sat and talked about it together. They all had some idea. I wasn't that married to one, and I was kind of looking for ideas, and the session zero actually talking with what they were doing gave me the impetus, the idea of what my role was going to be within the group as a character. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things I find it's harder to really establish when you've got the more free form story games, where you're not really playing with preset archetypes. Like, for example, doing something in Fate where everything is built on the aspects that you create for your character, it can be a little fuzzy, I've found in some cases, to have those clear-cut rules versus games that have the classes or clans or archetypes or some kind of pre-existing structure where it's very clearly defined. This is what you do in this group. This is what you offer. And these, you know, are some of your potential challenges. And that's why you need to be part of a group, because on your own, you're not going to be able to make it, you know, and all this kind of stuff. The freeform stuff is where it gets really tricky. And that's where, once again, Session Zero is really handy to kind of say, kind of out loud, what I'm aiming for is this type of character. It's like, okay, so from the sounds of it, we've got someone who can hack computers. We've got someone that's going to be able to, you know, we got a getaway driver. We've got a sniper. It seems like we need somebody who can talk us out of trouble. So that's what I'm aiming for. And then start to put in all the individual pieces on how they want to do it. So that's one of those things. But yeah, like once you've got that kind of determined and defined in character creation, you can really go really far with it. And it's just such a really helpful tool for that focus, because otherwise it can be way too easy to just branch off. I remember in high school playing with these kids who were the definition of hyperactive nerds. And it was one of those things where they were constantly jumping around all over the place. The whole semblance of, you know, time and space and only being able to cover one room at a time was completely foreign to them. They just were constantly, they would split the party, and then somehow their characters were able to bounce from room to room to help out and do all this stuff. Oh no, I know how to do this. I'll open this door. And just jumping around all over the bloody place. And one of the things I remember was that they were multi-classed, like insane amount of multi-classes. Each of their characters had four classes. And so as a result, they were kind of, each one was trying to be a one-man army. And so in doing so, they were constantly stepping over each other's toes, constantly getting that when I tried to join the group, I just kind of felt like it's, so am I just supposed to hang back and then when you all get killed, then I just try and survive this? Like, I think I remember only being in that group for like one session just because it was bonkers. It was way too much. It was like wrangling chickens with their heads cut off, yeah. You know, except that they were humans, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, it does so much to give everyone that clear sense of direction, because as we know, like with last time when we were talking about how there's a lot of connections with theater when it comes to playing a specific character, but those, you know, having that specific focus and that direction of what it is they do and what they can't do and what they shouldn't do, goes a long way, and then it lets you stretch things out from there. So it's a really helpful tool.
Oh, yeah. And not just in terms of that, but in terms of smoothness of play and conflicts. If you all have clear ideas of what your characters are good at, what they're not good at, who they are, it's so much easier to step aside and give somebody spotlight and not want to jump in, because everybody's aware of what people's fears are. You know, everyone's aware, like, for instance, the game I just brought up, and our, you know, that means that my character is going to be good. Like, if we get into a physical fight, if we have to strong arm somebody, intimidate somebody, my fellow players are going to kind of probably step aside and let my character do that. Meanwhile, if we have to talk our way out of something, my character's not going to speak up. Like, they're not good at that unless they're forced to. So they'll let the confidence man do it, because that's what they do. They convince people of things, you know, they instill confidence, you know? And so it's easy to let people have their moments to shine and cover each other's weaknesses and stuff like that, if everybody kind of has a clear idea of who their characters are and what they're good at, and not try to make them so much of a jack of all trades. I mean, you can have something like that, but it would have to be really worked out and stuff, or you kind of end up being on, stepping on people's toes, you know, a little bit. So it really helps in play and lessening conflict and things like that, if everyone knows what their character roles are. and yeah. and who their character is supposed to be and who they are. And it also lends the storyteller, the person running the game, the GM, as the person playing the GM, a way to kind of throw conflict in if they need to. Like, for instance, the GM knows that I'm the hitter, right? Like, I'm the one that uses my muscles and all this stuff. And then wants to kind of throw some conflict or tension in there, put me in a thing where I have nobody around, but I have to talk my way out of something, right? And see how that goes. You know, it also gives easy avenues for conflict and for pushing character growth or to see characters in different situations than what they're comfortable with as well.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It for really good examples, I always go back to the show Firefly. There was a crew, and each one of them, they had their own role. And there were times where, you know, when characters had to step outside of that role, like when Simon the doctor, you know, had to actually kind of, you know, like be part of the job and everything else like that. And it would be awkward, and that would be great moments of tension and everything like that. But at the same time, too, the group's success would not always completely hinge on those kind of things. But so it's nice every once in a while to know when you have a moment when you can just kind of breach that just a little bit, sometimes for a comedic effect, sometimes to kind of add the tension in the room. Sometimes if it's like if you've got your talker and your enforcer going into a room. I'm thinking of the scene from Mandalorian, actually, where they basically are infiltrating an Imperial base. And... you know, and the Mandalorian suddenly his skills, you know, as a mercenary, as a warrior and everything like that are not going to help in this particular situation. And that's what makes the scene so tense is because now he has to completely open expel. He's, you know, he's not even wearing his bloody helmet for crying out loud, which is such a core vital aspect of the character. He's so out of his element. And that's what creates that great tension in that particular moment in the story. It takes me back to, it reminds me of my old Shadow World campaign that at one point basically came down to only two players. They were, you know, I lost a couple of players because I was very fixed on what I was trying to aim for. And I only ended up having two of the players who were totally really on board. But one of, they had two completely different characters. One, my buddy John, he provided like a 20-page character background story, fully detailed. He had his parents named, he had siblings, they were related. It was very Tolkien-esque, just stuff like that, where I got this huge family history and it was a lot of detail, and he had something very particular in mind story-wise he wanted with this character. He was playing a sorcerer and he wanted to discover where his magic came from and what it meant, and it was part of a purpose and a prophecy and stuff like that. And then the other player, Kurt, he was a minotaur. His name was Brachus. He fought things. And that was it. That was the extent of his bio. So I had one player who really wanted to have very story-heavy focus, very character-driven story, with a lot of role-playing opportunities. And then I had another player who was just like, I want to see how many monsters my character can kill. And so I had to always be able to play up on that. So anytime that there were going to be moments in the story, especially too when there was going to be combat, I needed to make sure that there was something for the minotaur to keep him busy. So there always had to be like a big monster to fight, kind of like a Hellboy kind of a thing, so to speak. There's got to be something big for Hellboy to fight, and then maybe you've got some little critters that are skittering around for the others of the BPRD to deal with. That's how it was with Brachus. Mm-hmm. And then with the other character, Dorian, there needed to be something that was more of like he's a young sorcerer who's still struggling with his powers and everything else like this. So his was a little bit more kind of low key, that the characters were running on completely different experience levels. But we made it work because each player got to really fixate on the role that their character was designed for. And that's the thing, as a responsible GM,
right, exactly,
you got to play into that, because then it doesn't matter what disparities. Like, we had to stretch the game so much to make it work, because it turned out this was using D&D 3rd edition, when they said you can create monsters as NPCs, and then it turns out, wow, they're really overpowered when you do that. And that's what happened with Brakkus. It turns out he was actually 6 levels higher than how he was originally built, and it totally showed. So combat was really skewed. Man. Yeah, and it was hard to run. But when we did it, it worked really well, and they were invested. That when we finally came down to the conclusion of the campaign, only time I've actually run a conclusion for any campaign, I basically said, what's the biggest thing in the monster manual I could throw at Brakkus? And I just picked out a pit fiend, which is like a level 20 demon, a devil. And I said, go. And it worked so well so that while Brakkus was single-handedly fighting a pit fiend, Dorian is off rescuing his brother, who was captured because it turns out that he is going to basically be the Time Lord of the D&D universe and all this other kind of stuff. So while Brakkus is fighting this giant devil, Dorian is off escaping this castle, rescuing his brother from the clutches of evil and stuff like this. It worked so freaking well because we leaned into their roles so heavily. Yeah, it's so rewarding when you do it.
Yeah, it really is. And one aspect we haven't talked about, because we've been talking about like specific mechanical roles in the game. And one thing we haven't talked about is an aspect of the roles in a game of their character, which are personality. You have to make sure that whatever personality or whatever personality traits you're giving your character are not going to be something that is going to hit up so hard against somebody else that it becomes unplayable, you know? And because, you know, it's great to have characters who don't necessarily get each other and have arguments and feel like they want to do things differently than each other. That's fine. But there comes a point where it becomes detrimental. It's not character conflict that's like in depth and just fleshes out the characters. It becomes detrimental to playing the game.
Yeah.
And so you have to have that conversation. And also differentiating personalities, not just making sure they don't bump up against anybody else, but making sure that you all don't have like the same personality. All right.
Yeah.
Like, I've got, you know, if like my character in the werewolf game, he is a sarcastic, sassy, kind of embittered person. Okay. Which is a lot to deal with, but he has a heart of gold. And that's fine to play. But if I had another, and he's severely traumatized, and that's fine. But if I had the other characters in my pack, in my character's pack, were like that, that would be really hard, right? But thankfully, the other two characters are very more well-balanced, more compassionate, more empathetic, more likely to rein him in when he wants to say something and mouth off to somebody he shouldn't. You know, you have to make sure that if you're going to give someone a personality, that it creates a texture, it creates a pattern and not a monotone in your character's group, in your player group. You know what I mean? You want a wide variety of textures and colors and not just one thing, right? You know, yeah. I mean, that can be fun to play for a little while, but I imagine this is just me. And hey, if somebody hears this and you're like, I have a group like that and it's great, do let me know because I would like to hear that out. But if you had a group that was all sunshiny, optimistic, nothing's going to get us down, positive vibes only, and every single player in the group, every character in that group was like that, well, you know, I mean, then you have to start, you know, then you have to start looking at, okay, if I have a group of this type of people, what can I do to create conflict in that, right? As the player who's playing the GM role, right? Then you have to sit and think, well, the conflict is going to have to come from external stuff. You know what I mean? And that's all right. But the thing is like you have such a much more textured, more nuanced, more complex, deeper play. If not only do you have external factors, but internal conflicts within the group. And it just creates so much more in-depth, especially when those things play off each other. Like, hey, we just had an argument about what to do about this, but now we got to face this thing, so we got to pull it together and work together on it, even though we're still kind of mad at each other. You know what I mean? Like, you can have a group, I guess, of all one type of personality, but I would work to avoid it in a session zero. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Yeah. How do you feel about that? Have you ever had a group that was just kind of all one kind of?
Yeah, well, the one that I just mentioned, the one that I just mentioned earlier with, like, you know, the hypermaniacs running door to door and stuff like that, you know, like the single-handed speed dungeon crawlers, that they all were basically, you know, as I recall, trying to play the same type. And in doing so, we're constantly tripping over each other. Mm-hmm. They were having a blast. Which goes to the old adage of just, like, you know, as long as your group is actually having fun, then you're not doing it wrong. But it's definitely wasn't something that appealed to me because, yeah, role-playing games isn't just about doing something that you can't do in real life, but it's also too, you're trying to kind of skip over the real life bullshit that always gets in the way. You know what I mean? Like, if you're a charmer, you don't want to be a charmer who accidentally says the wrong thing. You want to know, you want to be reliably charming, where even if you fudge a role, you don't accidentally curse, you don't accidentally call the princess fat or anything else like that. You know, you're always smooth, even when it doesn't go well. You know, and so that's one of the things I find, even then too, constantly trying to, if everyone is very similar, then in order to stand out, your character has to overcompensate. And then that that's when things start to get a little absurd and a little out of hand and everything else like that. So yeah, it's definitely one of those things where having clearly defined rules, I think it's also too, now that I think about it, because I have a personal theory when it comes to game design that the majority of games are not mechanically built to support teamwork. Teamwork is often mechanically an option or something that requires system mastery. So, I mean, we had back in the days, there was the Gaming and BS podcast. There was an online forum. We had a fascinating, lengthy and very responsible conversation about this topic as to whether or not D&D is actually a team game, because everything is so individually focused. Think about it. Uh-huh. So many games, you roll individually as a character. You act as an individual. But it's how you play that is what makes it a group. And the only way that can happen is the GM can only support that so much. But when it comes down to it, the players have to take their roles and use it to work together. They have to find a way to gel, because otherwise it's just going to implode. And that's something that a lot of games, not like as a fault, it's just that's not how they're built. That's not what they do. You as the player have to make yourselves work together.
Yeah, totally. I mean, we could do a whole show about that, because I have hefty opinions about that.
Then we're definitely going to.
Yeah, I have hefty opinions about this topic. But to briefly stay as a teaser, I guess, is that we are seeing attempts in games to bring in more things to teamwork. But as you point out, they're usually mechanical things. You know what I mean? Or ways they have you do session zero. You know what I'm saying? Like, and you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think our game is trying to do a good job of making it more of a team effort than anything. But that's just my opinion.
Yeah, that was an active design goal for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and, you know, like 7C had drama die that could be given out and then used as a team. You know, D&D ended up doing inspiration, you know, that could be used. But those were encouraging role playing. I know there are games where it's like, okay, part of the session zero or making characters is that you have to create one connection with another character. right? So we're starting to see where games are kind of putting in and actively trying to create ways that, you know, the characters have basis to role play with each other or work with each other, or even, you know, mechanically, you know, hey, if you both work on this task, you can support them by rolling this many die, you know, whatever it happens to be. So we are seeing games trying to do that sort of thing. But I think, again, like you pointed out, it's a matter of you actively have to use it that way. You know, it's not inherent to the thing itself. It's something that they give you tools for, and then you have to use those tools to use those connections and use those to make it feel more of like a cohesive group, you know, working together, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's one of the things where no matter what level of role play you put into your role playing game, there's always going to be some amount of role play. Even if it's no one speaks in character, but they just say, my character hits on the bartender. You know, my character charms his way past the gate. My, you know, like they just say what it is they do, roll dice, you know, drop playing cards, whatever the case may be. And these kind of things happen. But they require you to take on that kind of act role and to make the mechanics of the game work in your favor to get whatever the objective of the game is. Clear out the dungeon, rescue the prince, any of this other kind of stuff. So, yeah, and that's where, once again, the player roles help with that kind of shortcut with it. Like, you know, I think all of us at some point in time have been in a group where somebody wasn't really quite grokking their character, and you get this kind of sense of aimless wandering from them. It's kind of like, ah, this isn't quite working out. You know, my guy's just not quite doing it, or I don't feel as special in here as I used to. And then they just, like, we had a guy back when I was in high school, when he would get bored, his character would just go up and just start chopping down trees. And it was almost kind of like his subtle way of saying, like, this isn't working, let's do something else, can we move on? You know, most of the time it was kind of like when we were in market, all of a sudden he would walk out of the town and start cutting down trees, you know, because we were shopping and, you know, like, oh, how much magic items can I get for this gold and everything like that. And he was just like, ugh, I'll just hunt for food to live off the land. Let's go. We got a dungeon. I want to fight monsters, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I mean, like, it's like those things that I mentioned. I mean, they put things in there like to give your character like a purpose, you know what I mean? Like in V5, you know, you got to put like, what type of feeder are you? You know, what is your ambition, you know, and stuff like that. So I do know games have tried to put things in there. You know, 7C had 20 questions where you're asking about the character to get to know them and stuff like that. So I think those things are helpful. And I think in a session zero, I've had the experience. I don't know if you had the experience, but like when I was talking about the vampire game earlier, I wasn't really committed. I didn't have an idea. I knew I wanted to be a Malkavian. Mm-hmm. And that was about it. But listening to everybody and kind of where we were going with it gave me my idea and a focus for my character. Like, remind your player that, or, you know, you can remind your fellow player or whoever's in the group, you know, you can remind them that, you know, you can talk about it and get ideas from other people, and they don't have to like know right away off the top of their head that discussing it and what other people are doing can help you get ideas of where you want to fit in and stuff like that. You know, I've had that experience, and like, somebody was like, oh, if your character is that and mine is this, maybe we know each other, right? Like, yes, maybe I helped you with this or something like that, you know? And so that's why session zero is so important for that sort of thing, too, to help players get a nail on who their character is so they know their role going forward and stuff like that. I think all those things are super important, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, stars and wishes are really good for that kind of thing, too. That can be, you know, moments where at the end of a session, it's basically, okay, let's, you know, you're giving not just the GM, you're giving the table feedback on this moment here where your character, you know, found a way to open up the safe. by getting the security guard to do it for him, I thought was genius. That was like the best part of the entire game. Mm-hmm. But then it also gives an opportunity to say, is like, you know, I kind of feel like my character's, you know, my character is a cavalier. He rides a horse. And it's like, you know, we're constantly indoors all the time. I think it'd be great if we had a moment for my character to finally show off his horsemanship. If that's the word. I think that feels like a word that's exactly. like, that's not the proper exactly. word. But yeah, like it's, stars and wishes are a great moment. Oh, yeah. Okay, good, good. Stars and wishes are a really great opportunity to give that feedback to say, you know, what y'all are doing is awesome. But there's something here that feels like it's missing. That's all, you know, it's not quite what we talked about in session zero. I feel like we got away from this. So that feedback is a continuous thing. It's like we talked about before, a communication that helps keep things moving. It's important to speak out when you feel yeah. that your role in the group, whether or not it's as the character, as the player character, or as the player at the table, is not being met, because that can also come down to where, you know, I've played in a game where there were 9 players at one table at one time. And that
Whoa,
is a
what?
Long.
Oh my
yeah.
God.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Here's the thing about it, too. It was, I joined this group before I got into a really bad car accident. After the accident, commuting was really difficult. And so I would join this group online while the rest of them sat at this giant table in a basement. There were times where I went an hour without saying anything because there's so much conversation, all this other kind of stuff that was going on at the table. All the camaraderie I was actually missing out on because their camaraderie would automatically mute my sound because someone was talking. And so it really, this is when for me, it was a really big moment because it really started to teach me, you know, how much the game is dependent on the camaraderie at the table and feeling like you actually fit in as
it
part of
so
the group.
It so is, absolutely.
Fundamental. Absolutely. And I know to this day, it affects my game design because I like to have things where there are things for players to think about. Kind of like metaphysically, at least in the sense of what can I do? What choices can I make? You know, how can I take these things and affect, you know, the game itself rather than just, okay, it's my turn. All right, well, I'm going to attack. Boom. It's like, okay, so if I'm aiming for this, I'm doing for this, there's something that can kind of keep you going, keep the wheels turning in between or other ways to contribute. You know, because, yeah, that isolation, it was very eye-opening. And I think it was one of the reasons when I started to kind of get out, because we were playing D&D, and that's when I stopped playing, because I started to see things about the game where it was just like, this initiative system sucks. I fucking hate this. Like, this, seriously, if I roll poorly this one time, that's how it's going to be for the next 2 hours? Like, that's a... That's a seriously fundamental role that we're just kind of glossing over here. And it changed how I make games moving forward. So I think
for
it's something
sure.
that's,
for
yeah,
sure.
yeah. I think it's one of those things where that's a good way to segue, if I do say so myself, into real world player roles. Like the things that players can actually do at the actual physical table itself, not just in your imagination and how you describe things. And so it's like there's a bunch of different things. It's there was always this, you know, misconception like we talked about before about how the GM always had the burden of taking care of everything. Players just had to show up. Sometimes they didn't even have to keep their character sheet. Sometimes the GM would keep it for them. So it was just like you just had to show up and then you would just play. But that's not necessarily always the case. I know one role that I've been really starting to experiment with this a lot myself, but one that I almost always do at my games, especially too when I'm doing something more like Pandora or, you know, like even too if I was going to be playing a game like Fiasco and we were, you know, kind of pushing some boundaries a little bit, is the idea of having somebody be what I call the safety marshal. where, you know, a person mm-hmm. whose job it is to basically kind of enforce the safety tools and keep an eye on stuff so that the GM can focus on, you know, they've already got the books in front of them and these other NPCs to keep track of and stuff like this, relying on a very busy GM to also pick up on subtle social cues and notice that someone's looking a little kind of uncomfortable with the situation. You know, I find that that's mm-hmm. asking for trouble, especially in really dark areas. So I like to have mm-hmm. someone else at the table take that responsibility, especially in an online game, you know, where it's like you could already be busy enough with, you yeah. know, you're just looking at a tiny little box and it's much harder to pick up some social cues, especially for some people on an online presence than it is in person. So that's something I find really important. Yeah.
That can totally work. I guess my only thought, because I usually generally posit that as everyone's responsibility. Like, I'll say I will do my best to keep that in mind. But as part of your player responsibility, you also need to know those lines and veils and know them so you don't cross them. That is also your responsibility, not just mine. I guess, as long as you have mature players, it's not going to be a big deal. But if you have somebody who's going to sit there and be like, well, nobody said anything, you know what I mean? Like, just because yeah. you have a role for that. And so you put it all on that person, it relieves the GM of it. But now you're putting the responsibility on that person who, you know, if something does happen and they miss it, you know, they get blamed for it because that was their responsibility to look after. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that would be my only concern. And with a mature group, it wouldn't be because everyone would be paying attention and be considerate of each other. But I always, in my session zeros, I always stress that as everyone's responsibility, not just mine. Everyone needs to be responsible for knowing the lines and veils. Everyone is responsible to have their safety tools in front of them, to use them, remind each other to use them, check in with each other, and all of that stuff. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. you can't have a person, you know, and what I might do is if I specifically know I have a scene coming up, I usually do warning. You know, I usually will say this scene may have some stuff in it. As far as I know, it doesn't go over lines and veils, but it may hit on something somebody didn't realize. And just bring it to the forefront, you know, and I might say to somebody else who's not in that scene, hey, just, you know, keep an eye on this with me. You know what I mean? If they're yeah. not in it, they can put their full focus on that scene to see what's going on. You know, while the others have more freedom to kind of play the scene as they want to. So I might do that and just warn everybody and have people who aren't in the scene keep an extra eye out for things. But in general, I try to stress that that's an everyone responsibility. That's an everyone thing that people need to do and be considerate of and remind each other of and support each other in. But that's,
yeah,
that's, yeah, it's just my yeah. thought on it.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And it's not something I have in every single game I run, but it's definitely something whenever I run Pandora, because when I run that game, you know, because it's a way of me cathartically working out, you know, like the things that that game gets into and my own family connections to that in the real world and stuff like that, I like having a person who is in charge of those kind of things, because, you know, we're going into some dark territories in that one. It's also, too, I have used like one-shots of RPGs to specifically tackle kind of like, you know, very, very dark subject matter. And that's when the whole idea of this specific player role came up. It was something actually Kate Bullock, she was working with me as like the safety editor when I was doing The Tower. And it was one of those things where that one has a lot of tendency to get into a really dark place. It's basically, I don't even call that one a game. I call it a role-playing simulation, because the idea of a game is that there's an insinuation of fun. And this was something where it's like, no, this is not intended to be fun. This is meant to be a reflection on a very serious subject matter. And so as a result, there was concern that people could actually accidentally rehash existing traumas and stuff like this. Like, we worked with someone who specializes in post-traumatic stress disorder, particularly within, like, you know, soldiers and that kind of thing, to make sure, you know, like, if someone were to run this in a therapeutic session, what would we need to do to provide, to really enforce the safety tools above and beyond because of what we're doing? And so when it's cases like that, I like that comfort of knowing that there is someone who is there kind of watching my back.
For sure, especially if it's a game. Especially if it's a game that is that. Like, you're going into it knowing it's a dark game. It has dark themes and stuff. I can totally see where having something separate for that in consideration is necessary, right? Because you're sitting there going, it's not just going to be a scene or two. It's basically the whole theme of the game is this. You know what I mean? Like, it's the whole thing. It's the whole thing. I mean, other than that, I always, you know, in terms of specific player roles as the player when they're at the table, not their character role or what the character's trying to do or their role in the party or their personality or anything like that. But as far as player role, this is usually a spiel I give. And I try to set expectations. And I say, these are my expectations as a player if I'm running the game. And I ask them what their expectations are as a player for not only me, but for other players. And they generally run quite a few things. One, I do stress that I expect everybody to pay attention to lines and veils and everyone to be considerate of each other in terms of, you know, those lines and veils and pay attention to them and use their safety tools. That's everyone's responsibility. Every player, the GM, everybody sitting at that table. It's your responsibility to know what's on your character sheet. Like, I try my best to know, but the thing is like, I've got NPCs and I've got y'all to worry about as the player being the GM. So you have one, and I need you to be informed about the stuff you have on your sheet and the things that you have available to you. So I expect that from them. I expect them to also be able to handle conflict. You know, I'm saying, I'm the GM, I'm running the game, I'm getting the setting, I'm giving the story to you. And yes, I am a rules mediator. That does not mean that in terms of conflict between players, that's my job. That's a lot to expect of me. I'm a fellow player like everybody else. It's all of us. If somebody clashes outside, like somebody is not treating somebody's character the way they hope and it's really making them upset outside of game, you know, if they don't want to bring it to everybody else, you know, bring it to each other first and try to mediate it as adults. And if they need a third person, bring it to the other players or somebody else. But I always tell them, there's a big difference between expecting the GM to moderate rules and make rule calls and decisions and putting the burden on them to be like a teacher or a judge or anything like that when it comes to conflict. You need to handle those things just like you would any other conflict in any other situation, a work situation, a friend situation, any other situation. You need to handle that the same way, with the same amount of maturity, the same amount of coping mechanisms, and all of that, you know, because there's too many times you've seen it where there's especially when I was younger, not so much now that I'm older and don't have time for that sort of thing anymore, but especially when I was younger and in college, you know, the GM would be expected to, like, arbitrate between these friends and choose sides because they were having some kind of player disagreement, you know what I mean, about their characters. You know, not just an in-character, haha, we're having a good time conflicting with each other, but I mean outside of it, you know, they have different expectations, they're not being met, and all of that stuff. And they kind of expect the GM to be arbiter of that, right? Be the judge, jury, and executioner and hand down a decision and be like, my word is law. And I don't work like that when it comes to that. I say, I moderate rules. I will make rule calls because that's what I'm supposed to do, and make rules about the world that we can come to together if asked. But in terms of player conflict, that's an everybody problem. That's an everybody needs to step up and be mature about it and use their conflict resolution skills and not abdicate that responsibility just because it's a game situation and it's a bit of a different social situation, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Indeed. Exactly. I think what you were mentioning there about, you know, helping the GM with certain things, I think that's something else that a lot of players don't realize that they can do that really makes a huge difference in the game experience itself. Where, you know, like for me, having someone else who can take notes has always been a godsend because I can get so caught up in the moment that I don't think to write something down. And then I totally forget what it is. And, you know, then the next session, I can't remember what the character's name is or something like that. Now, mind you, I've been getting better at it since playing Ironbound because I've been using my Book of Shadows to take meticulous notes because I have mechanical incentive. If I, you know, if I draw something that I wrote down in advance in my book, I get to add one die to the roll, you know, so then there's an incentive to write it down now. But in general, I really like it when there's someone else at the group who can handle that kind of stuff. When if you're doing anything
that involves Did you ever play Castle Falkenstein?
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that, and I think it was something that we did talk about it, I think, on the mics, and I think it was recorded. But yeah, it's on, like, my growing list of games I got to check out.
Part of that game is you have to have a journal for your character. Like, every character that's, like, part of the game has a journal. And so it's kind of like everybody is expected to be note-keeper in that game.
Nice. Nice. Mm-hmm. I like that touch. Yeah. It makes me think, too, the first edition of D&D, someone at the table was specifically assigned as the mapper. Like, there wasn't a map you could lay on the table. It was the DM would describe the room to you, and then someone was in charge of drawing it down on a piece of grid paper and keeping track of where you were at all times. That was a specific role in the game. That they have since kind of moved on and stuff like this, you know, and now they provide maps and all this other kind of stuff. But I remember that very vividly. And even then, too, when I did play, when I first started, that's how we did things. Someone was always in charge of actually drawing out the map, which was kind of slow and meticulous because then it was just like, how many feet was the hallway again? It was 40 feet, Dave. Okay, so each square is 5 feet, yes? You know, and then it's just like, and then drawing one at a time, you know, and stuff like this. It's just like, all right, I'm gonna start drinking beer while you do that. But, you know, it was still like an effective, it was effective in some games, especially when we were doing Ravenloft games, because getting lost was a major fear, was a big problem. If we got lost, we were just like, oh no, we're screwed, you know. But if it was for something else, it was a little more not as firm or not as intense or something like that. It was just like, oh, can we just move this along? Yeah. But it was way better than the GM having to stop everything, doodle on a map and all this other kind of stuff. So there's other ways that players can help run the game and kind of help move the process along, keep the pace going at something comfortable for the group. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Let's talk about, if you don't mind, I'm going to talk about something that I feel like players often don't realize that they can do, right?
Let's hear it.
There are roles that they can take on within the group as a player or as a character that they don't often. And when I see it, I'm really happy to see it. It mostly has to do with, like, when you think about the GM, right, you think they're, you know, that player is responsible for the story, is responsible for the player, you know, engagement, is responsible for all of this stuff. And it's true and it's not true. The GM is responsible for some of that, but I feel like no more than any other player. Players don't realize the power in going as their character to another character and engaging them in a conversation, right? Or asking them something about their past. You know, you as a player have a big opportunity, bigger than the GM who has to do that for all the players. But you have an opportunity as your character to be able to create opportunities and role-playing moments, not just role-playing opportunities, but also like battle opportunities or event opportunities or action opportunities for your fellow players. You have the power not just facilitate your good time by being a good player and paying attention and being compassionate, but you also have the power as a player to facilitate other people's enjoyment of the game as well. And I think so many underestimate that ability, right? There's so much power in, like I said, going up to another character and asking them about stuff or bringing up what they might be feeling. Like going up to a character and be like, hey, you know, I know that was your teacher. Like that must have been so hard to tell them goodbye. You know, like my, you know, like, and have that moment, right? But not only that, but the power as a player, if you're in a situation, to look at another player and be like, hey, doesn't your character have a really high this, that, and the other thing? Or doesn't your character have this object? Maybe you should be the one to go and do that. Like volunteering other players to do things, you know, other player characters to do things, you know, that sort of thing. Players have so much power to do that. And I think it's so rarely we see it used to its fullest extent in certain games. I know. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree. Even too, if you're doing something where there's a lot of tactical options involved, there's a lot of player options, you've got feats, a list of skills, so many spells, all this other kind of stuff. Having, you know, the other players at the table remind you, hey, don't forget, you've got that +2 because you're flanking. You know, like, oh, don't forget, you know, like, you know, you're really mad. So you get to, you know, roll 2 dice and choose the best one and that kind of stuff. Those little bits of helpfulness to make sure that everyone is using the game to its fullest potential, or even to games that have any kind of a bond mechanic, I find is really good for this, where there's a mechanical incentive for you to really play up on these aspects of the characters. But they have to be things most of the time that you have role played into the story. You can't just pull it out of thin air and, you know, like between sessions say like, you know, like, you know what? Me and Captain Archangel, we're best of buds. I'm going to write that down on my sheet. I'm going to send him a text. Done. We're best of buds. And then you start pulling that out of the table and everyone else is just like, when did that happen? You just tried to kill him the last session. Why are you suddenly best buds? You've got to bring that into the story, and it never really works well when a GM tries to force it. You know, it can lean into one of those discomfort areas of just like, it makes me think of the episode of Community when they're playing D&D and Abed wants Jeff to, you know, flirt with the bartender or whatever it is. And Jeff's like, Abed, I need you to tell I'm not comfortable with this. And just like, she seems disinterested and wants nothing to do with you. You know, it's like, you don't want to have that, because if you're forcing somebody to do something they're not comfortable with, it gets awkward.
Yeah.
And then it becomes one of those wishes at the end where it's just like, I wish that didn't happen again. So it's up to the players to really kind of lean in on that. And if you want to have something where it's just like, you know what, I feel that there's got to be a way that my character can help this character out in a moment like this. And if your game has a bond mechanic or something like that, that's a way where you can lean in on that, you know? And that's a really effective way. There are quite a few mechanics that even in your more traditional games, they require something in the narrative, they need role playing to actually trigger it and make it a thing. It's not always available just because it's on the sheet. And so it takes the players to do that and do it effectively. Otherwise, it feels like a show where, you know, like whenever you watch a show or you read a book and it's just like, I feel like the character only did that because they needed to do it, not because they wanted to, not because it's in their character where, well, someone's got to find the dead body in the cellar, so I'm going to make it this one. And it's like, yeah, but they're not a curious person at all, you know, kind of stuff like that. So, yeah, for sure. Yeah. That, I think, is almost exclusively a player, almost kind of like player dependent. That's the kind of thing about role playing. It has to come from the players. It can't be forced by the GM. Otherwise, you're really in a railroad game.
And it makes sense when you get the mindset that the GM is a player as well, right? When you really get that mindset in there that the GM is just a type of player with a certain role, that makes more sense, right? Because like I said, like you were saying, there's so much power in being able to do that. And I swear some of the best scenes, some of the best things that have happened in role-playing games that I've run, I was not even a part of, honestly, I'm telling you. And I was running the game. I'm serious. Like, I was running the game. And the best scenes were ones where two players were just, they were having something going on and they were talking or they were fighting with each other or whatever. They didn't need me. they were on it. You know, their characters had something going on. They were having these talks. You know, they were doing these things for each other. I mean, good Lord, that's some of the best stuff. Like, one of the best scenes that happened in like the first season of my vampire game that I'm like halfway through the last season of ending. You know, we've been at it for a few years now. But one of the best scenes in the first season of that, the first section that I ran, was the scene where the big climax have happened. And all four of them are sitting, or three of them are sitting in the back of the, you know, my Ventru character's limo, you know, the Ventru player's limo. And they're sitting there. And they've gone through this climax. They've had all these things happen. And they were just sitting there. And then they had this conversation about... and it was something innocuous. It was like the music that was playing or something like that. And it was just this... But it was so fraught with like what they had been through. And then they kind of drifted from that to actually talking about what happened. And it was one of the best scenes, right? And I wasn't involved in it. Like, they were just three characters sitting in this limo having a discussion about what had just happened. And it was one of the best things. Like, all these characters getting to know each other. And it was great. And it didn't have anything to do with me in that instance. So, you know, it's they have so much power to do that. And I really, really wish if anybody takes anything away from this in terms of player roles, really understand how much power you have to make or break somebody else's game. You know, understand that power that you have, you know.
Yeah. It got me thinking because I asked on Facebook, you know, like, what are some unique player roles, you know, that, you know, other people have at their tables and stuff. And the one guy, he mentioned the Agent of Chaos, that he's got a player where their specialty is thinking outside the box. And when they're stuck, this player is really good at coming up with a conceivable, believable, and applicable different idea that's like, yeah, that could work. You know, that moment when things are getting a little kind of stuck or things are just kind of going a little humdrum, that this player just has a way of just introducing something into it that just mixes things up and makes it unique. It makes it interesting for the GM too, you know, because sometimes as the GM, it can be a little kind of ho-hum. It's just like, okay, going through the motions, we're on round 8. Okay, I've still got 5 goblins, and it's just like, hold on a sec. You're going to pick up one of the goblins and swing them around like a club? Interesting. I'm going to include a roll to see, you know, if this happens. You know, like, if you miss that he accidentally goes flying and maybe knocks into a column, and that column causes some of the roof to collapse and stuff like this. You know, like, that little thinking outside the box can make a difference where... You know, and that to me, I never thought of as player roles as being something that takes advantage of a player's style, a player's approach to gaming. You know, it's kind of like you've got the rules lawyer sometimes. They're the ones who are just like the hard and fast on everything that's written exactly in the book, you know, And then there's the others who know how to tweak the game and make it work in a way that maybe wasn't intended, but they didn't fix it, so we're going to do it anyway. It reminds me of my buddy Adam. That was his specialty. He could just always find a way to cheat and say, well, it doesn't say we can't do this, so boom, do that. And then, you know, it works out the best way possible, and then you have to fix it and tweak it for the next session so it never happens again.
Yeah, and well, that works into the very last thing I was talking about. You know, you've got your player role at the table and what they're kind of expected to do. And we've talked about note-taking. We've talked about supporting the other players at the table, et cetera, et cetera. We've talked about the character role that the player has, love their character within a group. And the third one is, what does the player expect out of the game, right? What is their role in terms of what they want? Are they a puzzle solver? Are they a role player? Do they like the numbers? Do they like problem solving, right? You know, like, what is it that they like? You know what I mean? Like, what is it that they're, what role do they like to have in that context? Like, what's their niche of an aspect of gaming? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like, if they're more of the storyteller, you don't necessarily need to place something down on the table. You know, as the GM, it tells you, it's just like, I know that if I suddenly start to increase my pace and I start talking about the fact that the clock is ticking and it's almost about to hit midnight, and if they don't open the door at my midnight, all of a sudden this entire castle will turn into a pumpkin and squish them into tiny little seeds. Versus those who are more mechanically inclined, and they like to see like a clock at the table, like the kind of clocks you see in a lot of PBTA games. And they like that physical marker of just like, oh crap, you know, two more bad rules and we're toast and we're out of this scene completely and stuff like this. So knowing what they're trying to get out of the game tells you how you can kind of, I want to say manipulate that, but also to just kind of, you know, tweak it and adjust and approach things, you know, where, like, I know some players who all I need to do is throw on the right mood music in the background, and that gets them going into it because they're very, you know, audio visual kind of thing. I also know that there are some players who totally dig the idea of playing a horror game by candlelight only, whereas others, you know, like they want a normal ambience and stuff like this. They have other ways that they get into it. So yeah, you're right. Like, you know, knowing how they like to play can really give you cues on to how you can kind of push those buttons for them, you know, to get that reaction, to give them what it is that they're looking for.
Right, because that's a role in and of itself, right? To know about, you're like, hey, I'm throwing in this real dramatic speech in there because I know this player, you know, kind of has the role of they like, you know, monologues and all of this stuff. So I'm throwing that in there for them, you know, because I know that that's a role that they like to take on. You know what I mean? So putting things in there that you know they like to get involved in as a player, you know, is really helpful and stuff like that. Not only that, but if the players know that too, they can do that, right? And engage the other player in what they like to engage in. You know what I mean? It's super important. And I mean, I have players like groups are so different, you know? So having those discussions about roles and expectations in a wide variety of ways is super important. I have a group that, no kidding, I was playing, my husband was running this game, and it's our werewolf game, and we went shopping. We went to this, you know, trailer where, like, we could buy stuff we needed for this confrontation, and I kid you not, we are having so much fun talking to the NPC and, like, looking at fake stuff. We were there for, like, an hour and a half, okay? Like, you know, we were there for like an hour and a half just doing that. You know what I mean? And for other groups, that would be a no-go. Like, they would hate that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's, you know, it's, it gets me thinking as we're talking about this, a lot of it is about player buy-in. And I think probably the ultimate genre where you really need to know, like, your skills as players, all the players, GMs and everyone included, really get put to the test, it seems, in a horror game. Because that seems like a genre that requires the most buy-in in so many ways and form. I remember talking to Nathan Paletta at Breakout Con once. He was just in the middle of kickstarting a horror game based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe, I think. And I asked him, it's just like, how do you get that kind of reaction from players? How do you get them into a horror game, like in a convention setting, like the loudest, most cacophonous setting that you could possibly imagine? Why not do it in a football stadium while you're at it? And it was just like, how do you do it? And he said, they come to the table ready for it. You just need to make sure that you're giving them the cues that they're looking for in that particular kind of horror that you're running for them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's one of those things where it's like them sitting at the table is the first step, because they said, ooh, a horror game? Oh, it's about Cthulhu? I'm in. And they sit down and they're ready to rock and roll. So yeah, to me,
they're ready for tentacles.
Heard,
they're ready for cultists. Yeah, they're ready for,
right,
you know, all that stuff.
Not winning. They're ready to not save the day. You know, it's just like, yeah, oh yeah, my character's going to get killed and probably have to wear, you know, get locked up in a padded cell. I totally want that to happen. So yeah, I think that's kind of like the ultimate test, where it's like, if you're running horror games and you're getting these kind of reactions, you're nailing it. Like, you are, you know, king of the table, and all of us should bow before you and ask for your autograph. That's the way I look at it. Horror RPGs, I want to run one of these days, but I feel like I need to practice. I need a Rocky montage of warming up and punching, you know, like oak trees and this kind of stuff before I get to that level of play.
Well, did you know that those are like my favorite genre of games to run?
Why do you think I brought it up?
Okay, is that a hint? Because I have things I've learned over the years, for sure, running horror games. But unsurprising to no one, we have run over time by a bit.
We have, yes. So let's save that for, that should be another episode talking about horror games.
You know what? You know what could be a series? Yeah, you know, that could be like a series. We could do, let's talk about horror RPGs and how to run one of those and expectations for that and how to run a good one, and then do sci-fi and fantasy. What if we do like some different genres, talking about running games in those genres?
What do you think? I love that idea. I love it.
Cool. All right. Well, see, you all have stuff to look forward to. So let us know. What about player roles at your table? Let us know, how does it work at your table? What ideas do you have? Is there stuff we haven't mentioned? We'd love to talk about it. Join our Discord and come and chat with us about it. Join us. Find us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook. We are all over those places. And until then, we wish you a little gaming.
No, kick everybody out of the Cup Instead just yet. No, because
come back, everybody.
We forgot there's pie. This is our last episode that we're recording for 2022, which is our first year of this podcast. And we just wanted to take a little moment just to kind of, you know, mark this milestone. I'm very big on marking milestones. I'm one of these suckers who's just like, where were we a year ago at this time and all this kind of stuff. So I know myself, we wanted to, take a little moment to recognize this and to say that, you know, with the next year that's coming, obviously we have no shortage of ideas for recordings, for episodes and everything. I know for myself, I just wanted to take this moment to thank everyone who is listening, you know, now and in the future, maybe even too in the far future, maybe out in the deepest reaches of outer space, somewhere out there, there is a species of aliens that we have not yet discovered who has picked up this frequency and said, you know, like, what is this coven stead that they speak of? Quick, take us to your coven mates. Yeah, so this has just been like an absolute pleasure. And I also wanted to specifically take a moment to thank Danny, you specifically, you know, like as my partner in this little venture, and always being there and always being patient and supportive with the internet issues. And that's the most we're going to discuss on that, because that is, you know, ancient history as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, for just being there and just, you know, consistently.
That's like a line or veil. Like, we don't talk about that. It's a line or veil. Yeah. We just don't talk about the internet.
It's a veil. We'll mention it by that code, but then let us never speak of it again.
Yes. Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I appreciate you so much, too. I always have so much fun talking to you, and it makes me think about how I actually feel about these things. You know, you do stuff and doing a deep dive on how do I do things and how do you do things and thinking about it and what is that process and why do I do those things is so helpful. And I think everyone should do that in regards to their games and their magic. If they're doing magic, you know, self-reflection and pondering that is super important.
Yes.
Do we have any? So thank you so much, Todd, for talking with me and all of that stuff.
No problem. My pleasure. And then let's also, for our very first time, let's give the list of our Kickstarter backers, because that was also something that was a very cool thing we were able to do this year. And so I figured too, we'll do it. We'll read it now. And so this way, if we mispronounce anybody's names, because, you know, I'm a stickler for that, I want to make sure everyone's name is pronounced properly. I am not Mr. Crepier. I am Mr. Crepper. So yes, let's give a big thank to our backers. So there's Alex, Brian P. Kurtz, Century Guild, Chris Etrata, Civ Light, Danielle Thomas, Derek Semsick, Fool's Moon Entertainment, Jacob Wood, Jason LeDuc, Kaboom.com, minus five O's, no apologies. That's what was written down, so that's what we're doing. Nicholas Diak, Phil Indeed. Watson, Revna, Tim Brannon, and Victor Wyatt. So thank you very much for your support and belief in this show and for helping other people to discover the Covenstead podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you for for donating and helping us to rise to another level.
And even to just a little bit of encouragement, the little, you know, posts on our Facebook group and, you know, and on our Discord and everything like that. Just the little bits, that little recognition that it's like, you know, we're not just talking into a void, you know, that someone's eavesdropping on us in a good way.
We do that on our own time. Like, we talk into the void on our own time, not on the podcast. That's right.
So now that we've done that, how about we go to that infamous closer of yours, Danny? Let's hear it.
Indeed. We wish you a little gaming in your magic and a little magic in your gaming.
The Covenstead podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.